It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the art of television. With 500 plus channels, there's plenty of trash to watch on TV. But peel away the clutter of reality shows and shopping channels, and there's a whole new generation of brilliant TV drama. Stuff you don't even have to feel guilty about watching.
To each generation, a slayer is born. One girl in all the world, a chosen one, one born with the strength
and skill to hunt the vampires, to stop the spread of their evil blah, blah, blah. I've heard it, okay?
Someone once told me time is a flat circle. Everything we've ever done or will do, we're gonna do over and over and over again.
All of this has happened before. All of this will happen again.
A television show is this living, organic thing that changes over time, and the author can't control it in the way that a novelist can.
I don't want to freak you out, but I think that I may be the voice of my generation.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
I am the one who knocks.
From Deadwood to Breaking Bad, Friday Night Lights, The Wire, Mad Men, we're living through a TV revolution, an explosion of great shows with terrific writing and brilliant acting. It's even getting hard to keep up with them all. So what's happened? TV critic Alan Sepinwall tells the story of the last two decades in a book called The Revolution Was Televised. Alan, your book makes the case for a golden age of television that starts around 1997. First of all, what do you mean by a golden age?
I mean a period in which, you know, if you were to come up with a list of the best, you know, TV dramas that had ever been made and you only wanted to include shows that debuted at the time of Oz and after, you could make a very plausible list. Some of the very best shows ever to be featured in television have been on the air in the last 17 years.
Okay, you mentioned Oz by HBO. What else?
There was Oz, there was The Sopranos, there was The Wire, 6 Feet Under, Deadwood, Lost, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Friday Night Lights, you know, up through Mad Men and Breaking Bad. And
okay, now right, everybody's favorites, right? So, but there were good shows before this revolution, right?
Yeah, there was West Wing debuted the same year as The Sopranos. West Wing I sort of look at, though, as this great last gasp of the traditional TV drama machine. It's really, really good, especially the first 2 years, but it much more resembles what had come before than what was going to come after.
So what makes the shows in your book, these shows we've been talking about, what makes them different from the earlier programs? I mean, is it better storytelling, better actors, more complex plots?
More complex plots, more adventurous visual style, much more ambiguous morality. I mean, that's a big part of it, is the idea that you could build a show around somebody like a Tony Soprano or a Walter White or even a Don Draper, someone who you're really not supposed to sympathize with, because there had always been this rule that, you know, characters on television have to be fundamentally likable and sympathetic, you know, on some level, even if they initially seem edgy. And this was not the case. So these shows trusted that their audience would want to watch a good story regardless of whether they liked the people, regardless of whether they initially understood the world. These shows threw you into the deep end of some very murky water and figured you would be able to swim.
That's interesting that you kind of pull out the strand of the anti-hero, because when I think about it, I guess most of those shows that you're talking about do have either anti-heroes or a high proportion of unlikable people.
Well, there's the old phrase that imitation is the sincerest form of television, and because The Sopranos was the first big hit of its kind, everyone said, okay, let's do a show like that. So when FX decided to get into this business, they basically did The Sopranos as a cop show with The Shield.
Well, Sopranos really was the game changer. You write that it rewrote the rules and it made TV a better, happier place for thinking viewers. What all did The Sopranos do to rewrite the rules?
Here was the show that was weirdly all things to all people, even though it wasn't designed to be. So if you just went in wanting a mob show, you could get that. If you went in wanting a complex psychological drama, you could get that. If you wanted family drama, you could get that. So it had all of these different elements to it, all of which were being done at an extraordinarily high level by David Chase, the creator, by all of these actors, the late James Gandolfini, Edie Falco, everybody else.
Is there a single episode or even a moment, a scene in Sopranos that for you really exemplifies what's different about it, what it did differently?
Yeah, the fifth episode, College, of the first season, where Tony takes his daughter on a tour of New England colleges that she might go to, and in the middle of it, he spots this, you know, rat who went into witness protection and decides he has to kill him now to punish him. And so it's, on the one hand, he's trying to be a father, and on the other hand, you witness him strangle a man to death with his bare hands who was not a threat to him. This isn't self-defense. This is just mob retribution. And that was the moment where you knew this was a show that had the courage of its convictions. It wasn't going to flinch at who this guy was or what this world was like.
Good morning, rat.
Who are you? What is this?
Don't make me laugh. You pimp.
Teddy, there must be something we could do.
Tony, you know how much trouble you're in now? You took an oath, and you broke it.
I could have killed you last night outside the motel. Your daughter was drunk, remember? I was there in the parking lot. I had a gun, but I didn't do it. Because of her, I told myself, it's just a coincidence. He's taking his little girl to college.
You know, one thing about us wise guys, the hustle never ends. You shot me at that motel, your life would have been flushed on a piece of dude.
Please, Tony, I'm begging.
And it was also going to blend in what's going on with him trying to be a father and trying to be a good person, even though he is an utter monster.
Has the portrayal of women characters gotten as nuanced and complex as the portrayal of, you know, the male antihero?
Definitely not. That is by far the area in which TV could stand to improve the most. And there have been some isolated instances. There was the Glenn Close evil lawyer character on Damages. There was Claire Danes for the first couple of years on Homeland, although I think they ultimately pushed that character too far. Laura Dern on this great HBO show that nobody watched called Enlightened was just wonderfully prickly and, you know, really pushed a lot of buttons. And now a lot of the women on Orange is the New Black, Kerry Russell on The American. So we're starting to move into that area. But a lot more work needs to be done.
So a lot of the shows that we're talking about are set post 9/11. And I wonder, do you think, is that just coincidence? Or is there something about television and 9/11 coming together that is responsible for some of these shows?
No, I think that's definitely the case. I think the national worldview changed. We became more scared as a people. We became more concerned about the future. You know, we became the first generation where we weren't guaranteed to do better than our parents had done before us. And all of that filters down into these shows. Even something like The Sopranos, which had been on the air and aired three seasons before the towers fell, you know, that impact is felt very much in the later seasons, whether they're talking about terrorism or not. I mean, I've always said that the best TV show about 9/11 is Battlestar Galactica. I mean, this is a show with spaceships and robots and, you know, sexy women in slinky red dresses. And that is a show that is 100% about 9/11 and the war on terror and everything that happened afterwards. And it just uses it the way great sci-fi does as an allegory. So it definitely filters into all of these unexpected kinds of stories.
Wait, for example?
You know, there are suicide bombings. You know, there's a memorial wall after the bulk of humanity is killed off that looks absolutely like the sort of things I saw all the time in Lower Manhattan in the weeks after the towers came down. There's a lot of talk about religious fundamentalism, about, you know, religious differences driving a lot of the tension that goes on.
The bombings, they got the Cylons' attention. They really got their attention, and I am not giving that up.
We are talking about people blowing themselves up.
You know, I've sent man on suicide missions in two wars now, and let me tell you something. It don't make a goddamn bit of difference whether they're riding in a Viper or walking out onto a parade ground. In the end, they're just as dead.
You know, people have been saying lately, you know, this little line is TV, the new novel. I've even talked with novelists who've said TV is the new novel. But I can imagine you might think those comparisons actually shortchange TV. Are there things TV does that, you know, are better than what novels do?
I think there absolutely are. And I think, you know, David Simon did a lot of talk about The Wire as the great novel for television. And I think it applies to that. But I think it does do a disservice because there are things that, for instance, actors can do with characters to breathe things into them that are not necessarily there on the page. You can do things visually that obviously you can't do on the printed work. While it can be great if you try to construct a novelistic television show, it can also be folly because you're dealing with a lot of uncontrollable elements. Maybe this actor wants to quit. Maybe this location you've been using for a lot of things, they want to sell that house. You know, different things can happen over time. And so what's interesting is a lot of these shows begin wonderfully and then end either confusingly, ambiguously, or in a way that just sort of upsets people. There's very few of the shows in the book where people are 100% happy with the ending. I would say The Shield is one. The Wire is probably one. Friday Night Lights and every other one, you know, there you will find pockets of people who are just angry because a television show is this living, organic thing that changes over time and the author can't control it in the way that a novelist can.
Is the TV revolution over?
I don't think so. Because of Netflix, because of Amazon, because of all of these new technologies and new companies coming into things, I don't know that there's quite as much of a concentration of, like, the best of the best of the best right now that there was when, say, HBO had The Sopranos, The Wire, Deadwood, and Six Feet Under all on at the same time. But there are just so many things all over the place and so many new things coming up all the time that I don't see this ending anytime soon.
Alan Sepinwall is a writer and critic for HitFix.com and author of The Revolution Was Televised: The Cops, Crooks, Slingers, and Slayers Who Changed TV Drama Forever. The golden age of television may have begun more than a decade ago, but if current shows like Game of Thrones and The Americans are any indication, it's still going strong. One of this year's biggest hits is HBO's True Detective, a police procedural that manages to be both gritty and poetic. Kind of helps that this season stars Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey. Steve Paulson recently sat down with the show's creator, writer, and executive producer, Nick Pizzolatto.
Nick, tell us about True Detective. How would you describe the basic premise of the show?
It's a story that uses the popular genre of police investigation to conduct a more nuanced metaphysical investigation into its characters and their world.
So, I mean, this is so interesting because, I mean, you're using, in a way, the conventions of the crime procedural. I mean, the whole business of trying to track down the killer without really quite fitting into that genre.
I think that was definitely one of the basic structural goals of the series, was to use the machinery of the procedural to get at what interests me, which is the dissection of character and motivation and a world vision.
And for a show that is ostensibly about searching for a serial killer, there aren't that many dead bodies. And the killer almost seems incidental at times, which is pretty unusual for a crime show, I would think.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think that's just an expression of the show's values. It's the horror that lies in the everyday. There's a way, and I think this is right, that in True Detective, the world itself is the crime.
What do you mean by that, the world itself is the crime?
Well, I mean that these two men and their world are a coagulation of history, of historical crimes and culture. One of the functions of all the granular details in background and in setting is to suggest this corruption at the root of the world, this poisoned garden. And the poison at the root of the world is humanity, which is also its only vehicle for meaning.
Humanity has somehow corrupted the world?
Well, the first story I ever heard was a noir story called The Book of Genesis. You know,
you call that a noir story.
Well, you know, if you just think about it, there's sex, there's palace intrigue, there's sexual betrayal, there's vengeance, and then there's two brothers and one of them kills the other one. And this is the first two pages. That's the first two pages. So it's always been suggested in our oldest literature that we're living after some kind of spiritual or metaphysical fall.
I contemplate the moment in the garden, the idea of allowing your own crucifixion.
But you're not a Christian, so what do you believe?
I think human consciousness was a tragic misstep in evolution. We became too self-aware. Nature created an aspect of nature separate from itself. We are creatures that should not exist by natural law. We are things that labor under the illusion of having a self, this accretion of sensory experience and feeling, programmed with total assurance that we are each somebody, when in fact everybody's nobody.
Well, and there's violence at least an atmosphere of violence that permeates True Detective. I mean, obviously there's the murder sort of at the center of the story, but even, you know, more than that, your two main characters, the two detectives, are they're violent men.
I mean, they're violent men.
They live in a violent world, and it plays out in their personal relationships. It plays out in the social structures that you see around and at the police station. Are you trying to draw parallels between sort of that everyday level of violence and then the violent crime that they're investigating?
Absolutely. Well, the parallels right off the bat are between emotional violence, the violence of broken trusts, and the physical violence enacted on women and children in the background of the series, sort of just off screen. That's what everyone's averting their eyes to, right?
So at one point, Marty Hart asks his partner, Rust Cole, do you ever wonder if you're a bad man? And Rust replies, the world needs bad men. We keep the other bad men from the door. Do you think that's true?
I think there's dangerous people in the world, and the dangerous people are often called upon to combat them. But I think Cole's point goes more towards Cole wouldn't say anybody wasn't a bad man.
And the suggestion is that violence is part of particularly this culture of masculinity in this part of Louisiana along the
Yeah, Bayou. I mean, you know, so much of this is where I'm from. There was always a consistent language of violence, at least when I was coming of age and growing up. And I think that is probably common anywhere you have a large population of largely powerless people living inside a system and under structures that they don't understand and haven't seen the benefit of.
Now, there's another theme that I would say runs throughout True Detective, and it's about how we construct narratives. I mean, we're constantly going back and forth in time between 1995, when these detectives first get on this case investigating this murder, and then 17 years later in 2012, after both have left the police force, they're talking about what happened. They're describing what happened all those years ago, and we're not sure whether we should believe them. Why did you construct the story this way?
You know, that Faulkner line that the past isn't over, it isn't even past. I've always felt that to be true. And if there was a way to juxtapose those things against one another and to use the idea of the interrogation, the police interrogation, it's another trope, right? But we're going to use it as a vehicle to dissect narrative and motivation and character.
This is going to happen again. Nor what's happened before. This is his vision. Her body is a paraphilic love map.
How's that?
An attachment of physical lust to fantasies and practices forbidden by society.
You get that from one of your books?
I did.
You got a chapter in one of those books on jumping to conclusions? You attach an assumption to a piece of evidence, you start to bend the narrative to support it, prejudice yourself.
Wait and see on the ID.
Well, it seems to be, I mean, you're dealing with truth-telling here, which is reflected in the title of your show,
Thank
True
you,
Detective.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes.
I mean, and truth at several levels. I mean, there's the search for the true killer. There's truth and honesty in personal relationships. There's how we tell a story, whether the stories we tell are true. And, I mean, the suggestion is we're kind of always fudging the truth to some degree.
As much as we might try to strip ourselves of illusions, what you're ultimately left with is the exact poverty of your knowledge, that you know very little about your situation as a human being on the planet Earth. And what you do know sounds like a noir story.
Yeah.
You're doomed.
Well, I have to ask you about Rust Cole, one of your two main characters, played brilliantly by Matthew McConaughey in the series.
Yes.
He's some kind of combination of master criminal investigator and interrogator and existential philosopher. And I got the impression that he's the one character who's willing to stare straight into the face of the absurdity of life without blinking, but he's also haunted. Where did you get the idea for this character?
Well, he was real close under the skin. You know, when Russ started talking, there was never much hesitation between keystrokes.
There's a lot of you in Rust.
in his intolerances, the things he is intolerant of, I would say so. But, you know, I've said before that he's certainly not a nihilist. He'd be the most unsuccessful nihilist in history. If anything, everything is overwrought with meaning for Cole. You know, he's hypersensitive. And in that way, what he's talking about with in the first episode, when you're meditating on the idea of your own crucifixion, is that for him to wake up and encounter the world and do this job is a form of self-crucifixion. His complaints aren't very different from Job's complaints. Yeah. And Job's complaint was that he was a character in a story and he didn't like how the story was being told. Right?
Now, the other thing I have to ask you about is the setting of True Detective, which is also similar to the setting of your novel Galveston. I mean, it's set in the South. I mean, True Detective.
It's almost the exact same setting.
Yeah. And we see oil rigs offshore. We see a lot of pictures of the working poor. I mean, the backdrop is there. I mean, it's almost like another character in the series.
Yes.
Why is the land so important to you?
Landscape has just always affected me on a sensory, personal level a great deal. Growing up in these areas, I always felt the landscape was almost oppressive to me. It was so flat, and all the trees had been cut down, and the only thing on the horizons was a refinery pumping smoke into the sky. These things were as much a part of me as my personal tastes. Henry James said, landscape is character. And I've always felt that way.
Well, I get the sense that your characters are kind of trapped in this landscape. I mean, you got out, but you keep writing about it.
Well,
but
yeah.
your characters don't get out.
Well, yeah. And we're all trapped. And the first thing that traps us is our ego, which separates us from the rest of the world and makes us think that we're all a bunch of different things instead of one thing. And then the cages just sort of multiply from there. And then you lay on top of that the narratives of family, the narratives of God and country. And this is before you even get to the landscape, mind you. And then the landscape with its economic depression and its lack of upward mobility and its lack of opportunities can be oppressive.
Do you feel like you're still in a cage?
Yeah, sure. Of course. I mean, I imagine I'll feel like that until I pass away, and then I won't feel anything. It will always live inside you, and it will never go away. Where you come from will always live inside you. And you need to be careful not to hate that place, I think.
That was Nick Pizzolatto, the creative genius behind HBO's True Detective. You'll find Steve's extended conversation with him on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're exploring the art of television. And it's not just critics and fans who think something's different in TV land. Laurie Moore is one of America's literary stars. A lot of people consider her one of the greatest living masters of the short story. And she not only watches TV, she thinks it's our newest literary form. And she's been saying so in print.
How I started writing about television is rather fluky. I mostly have done book reviews for the New York Review of Books, but I had heard so much about The Wire, and then I sat down one summer and just watched it all, and it was amazing to me. I didn't watch it when it was on. I mean, I couldn't stop. It was a little bit of a binge. But that's how one reads a novel. And so it has that, you know, resemblance to a novel in that way as well, the experience of it, not just the depth of the story itself, but also the nature of how a viewer goes about experiencing the narrative. So at any rate, I watched this, and then I wanted to read what other people had written about The Wire. And I went online, and I went to The New Yorker. Nothing. The New Yorker had not written a thing. I went to The New York Times. They had written a tiny little inch-long thing. I went to The New York Review of Books. Nothing. But the London Cultural press was all over the Wire. The London Review of Books and the London Times had written about it. So I said to Bob Silvers, I said, you want a piece on the Wire? I know it's kind of years late, but you've never, you know, published anything. And he's very open, lovely man. And he said, sure.
Let me understand you. Every Friday night, you and your boys will shoot crap, right? But every Friday night, your pal Snot Boogie, he'd wait till there was cash on the ground, then you'd grab the money and run away? You let him do that?
I mean, we'd catch him and beat his ass, but ain't nobody never go past that.
I gotta ask you, if every time Snot Boogie would grab the money and run away, why'd you even let him in the game?
What?
If Snot Boogie always stole the money, why'd you let him play?
Got to. This America, man.
Now, the quality of the acting is enormous. These actors right now, the depth of talent is just extraordinary. The slowness with which one is able to film and the leisureliness with which an actor can sort of interpret a particular moment is new. So these new dramas, and a lot of them are, you know, they're police procedurals, so they're following in the footsteps of other police procedurals. But they're going more slowly. And if you give a director and a cast and a bunch of screenwriters a lot of space and you say, you don't have to stop for a commercial every 5 minutes, you don't have to stop at all, then you're in a beautiful place that's even better than making a film. And so you have these novelistic television series.
Yo, why y'all playing checkers on the chess set?
See this? This the kingpin, all right? He the man. Now, the king, he move one space any direction he damn choose, because he's the king. But he ain't got no hustle. But the rest of these motherfuckers on the team, they got his back. And you see this? This the queen. She's smart, she fierce. She move any way she want, as far as she want. And this over here is the castle. It's like the stash. These are the pawns. They like the soldiers. They move like this, one space forward only. And they like the front lines. They be out in the field.
So how do you get to be the king?
It ain't like that. See, the king, stay the king.
I don't think that one needs to replace the other. There is a way in which when you read and come in contact with a single mind that is working very hard to burn its story onto a page. The solitude of it, the speaking of just one person to another, that will always be unique. But as collaborative art forms go, this long-form narrative cable storytelling has gotten very good.
Teddy told me that in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart. Far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel.
And that was from Mad Men, currently in its final season on AMC. Lauren Moore's most recent book of short stories is called Bark, and we posted links to her essays about The Wire and other TV dramas on our website at ttbook.org. And now for something completely different, a TV show broadcast only on the internet.
Out athlete and America's gay sweetheart married during drunken Vegas weekend. Now that's too long for a headline. See, this is why I'm an actor, not a writer.
Jesus! We're gonna look bad, and we're gonna make the cause look bad, and we're gonna look bad!
Well, people already kinda expect this sort of nonsense from me.
We can't be married. They're novelty rings, exchange in the spirit of high camp such as we gays are known for.
Satirical performance pop art.
Yes!
That's a clip from the show Husbands, a sitcom about two guys named Cheeks and Brady who wake up after a drunken night in Vegas, married.
There's a long tradition of newlywed comedies, like I Love Lucy and The Honeymooners, but this one's billed as the first marriage equality sitcom. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with the show's creators, Jane Espenson and Brad Bell, who also stars in the show.
You know, Brad, I want to read something to you because it's such a great review. I want to ask your opinion of it. Ira Glass of Public Radio fame said that Husbands feels like you're peeking at the future of TV that's just barely coming into existence. Wow. Is that accurate? Do you think that's what Husbands is?
Yeah, I think Ira Glass is a genius. I mean, that's tremendously flattering and also creates a pressure, I think. Like, oh, really? We were just kind of making a show. But yeah, it's interesting to see how the world has changed since we have started making Husbands and the world we live in now. You know, when we initially started, there was absolutely no conversation of athletes coming out.
Even there hadn't been a high-profile gay divorce like it's happening now. Like,
yeah, that's
like
true.
We were sort of, you know, the thing they're worried about. It was a little prescient.
Yeah, it's interesting. It got really stale. You know, I was thinking about the sitcom. You know, I'm 45 and I grew up watching like Three's Company and these shows. You're like re-owning it again.
Yeah, absolutely. It was about reinventing that. I mean, I think especially with Three's Company, you know, and the whole setup of him pretending to be gay. And,
oh, yeah, that's right.
You know, you look at All in the Family or Soap or Mary Tyler Moore or Murphy Brown. I mean, so many social issues have been tackled through comedy for centuries. But, you know, in the last century, through the sitcom.
And what's interesting is you look at a show like Modern Family and you can go, okay, that show is right now of the moment, you know, all the different kinds of families that make up that family. Then you look back and you go like, well, you know what was telling that same story but relevant to its time was the freaking Brady Bunch, which
right.
We don't think of as an issue show, but the notion of a blended family was sort of new at that point.
When thinking about the gay content, did you feel that you could explore this greater because you were online and you weren't being looked at by the networks?
I mean, yes and no. I think to say, you know, we could explore this online in a way that we couldn't on television sort of implies that it's edgy, it's got nudity, it's got sex, and it doesn't. I think that networks would be hesitant to tell this story just because it's gay people. You know, they're young and sexy and in love, and you don't see them doing anything that you wouldn't see on, you know, Mad About You. But even still, I think that that's a risk that networks at the time were, you know, not necessarily willing to take. And so we felt free in that sense. But, you know, we were certainly not pushing any envelope.
But there was a moment where you and the man you marry are holding hands. And there's this nice moment where you say, I love you. And you give him a kiss on the cheek. And I thought, now that's radical. Like, you could be naked and like whatever. But that fact that you're in love and normal, I thought that was way more edgy than a lot of other things I've seen.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like, you know, we're in an era where you can access really anything you want, as explicit as you want. And in this case, I think that showing these guys in a monogamous relationship, married and committed to one another and in love and not necessarily, you know, dancing at a club or doing drugs or, you know, whatever. I think in this sense, it's edgy.
I play baseball on TV, okay? TV gays, they sing about acceptance or host daytime talk shows for housewives or acquire babies from exotic locations like China or wombs.
That is so not me. You've met me, right?
Do you feel you have a responsibility, though, to, you know, hearkening back to Will and Grace, hearkening back to Ellen, some responsibility to normalize gays so that America can move forward with its acceptance?
Well, no. I mean, I think that would imply that gays are not normal and need to be normalized. Like, we need to package and sell them in some way that they aren't. I mean, you know, we're not doing anything but reflecting a story that we relate to and that I think everyone who's ever been in a relationship can relate to, because really everything is universal. You know, those emotions and insecurities and everything that you come up against when you're with someone is all the same.
There is something where I think we're pushing boundaries that other people aren't pushing, which is the character of Cheeks, who's the sort of smart one in the relationship.
And that's you. That's Brad's character.
And that's Brad's character. But he's the smart one in the character. He's also the more feminine of the two guys. And this idea of a character who takes their strength from femininity and isn't clownish in the process. I think that's something that we're doing that not a lot of other places are doing.
It seems like the characters in the TV show really struggle, though, with, I mean, there's a moment where one of the characters is a famous baseball player, and he has to go on TV because America's all fired up about the fact that he married another man and that he might get caught up in his morality clause with his baseball team. And poor Cheeks has decided to try to be more normal.
Specifically in that instance, it was Cheeks being more masculine because...
Right.
You know, you're more accepted not only by the heterosexual community, but also the gay community as well when you're, you know, well, yeah, maybe you like guys, but you're still a man, you know, you're a man's man. And so that was a point that, you know, we were making, is that femininity is not inherent with any of those things, and that a man can express himself as freely or as individually as a woman, for example, in society.
Honestly, I'm kind of a brain spin about what to say for this interview. I mean, I have spent so many years branding myself as someone who embraces stereotypes because disregarding society in favor of one's authenticity is a very important step towards self-love and personal empowerment. So I'm just nervy. I might slip and say something like that is all.
You know, when you talk about putting the show out online, do you feel like, sure, you're doing it, but it's such a lower bar to be able to get things online, to get things started. Do you think that's going to create more diversity for all other sorts of content as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it already has. And I wouldn't say it's a lower bar. I would just say it's more democratized. It's more accessible.
Yeah, it's democratized in every way. You're going to see a lot more diversity among the people making this sort of TV, which will filter into all forms of TV.
And let's go back to, say, Ellen and Will and Jack from Will and Grace. For people in my family, this is the first gay people they ever met. And of course, so they thought, but this is the first gay people they think they've ever met. You know, it's interesting that, you know, TV has been a really integral part of the gay marriage fight and for gay rights in America. So I can see why people would be worried about it. Where do you see yourself in that continuum? Where do you guys see yourselves in that fight?
We know that one of the things that most convinces people to shift their political beliefs towards marriage equality or towards gay rights is the number one factor is that they know someone from that community. Cheeks and Brady can be the ones that they know.
You know, this is so socially and politically complicated. Sometimes I wonder, like, can a sitcom really address such issues? Can it handle the gravitas?
I think a sitcom's a better medium because you tune in effortlessly. It's a half hour. Its passage is eased by humor. You don't notice that you are getting these political lessons. And that's coming from people you know and you like that you've invited into your living room for every week. I think it's the perfect medium for political expression.
Jane Espenson and Brad Bell are the creators of the sitcom Husbands. Charles Monroe Kane talked with them. Want to check out an episode? There's a link on our website, ttbook.org. That's all the time we've got for TV today. But coming up, poet and Iraq War veteran Kevin Powers will help us commemorate Memorial Day. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
You are about to experience a totally new dimension and
ideas. The intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous
Ideas.
This is Ralph Nader, and I have a dangerous idea, to politicians, that is, and it's this. Congress has been very willing in recent decades to give the presidency its constitutional authority to start wars. That is not the province of the presidency. Our founding fathers put it in the Congress. Only Congress can declare war. So here's my idea. Anytime Congress or the presidency or both are about to plunge our country into war abroad, every able-bodied and age-qualified child or grandchild of every senator and representative are immediately drafted into the armed services. Just the prospect of that will ensure that Congress will pull back its responsibility to declare war, have a deliberative, open process of committee hearings and witnesses, all the way from citizens and retired admirals and generals who tend to be more willing to wage peace, having known the bloodiness of war, to restrain what has now become an incredible spreading and sprawling empire of aggressive wars, which by definition violate international law and the UN Charter to which our country solemnly belongs. It'll be a one-page bill, and it will prevent a lot of wars, a lot of human sacrifice here and abroad, a lot of boomerangs against our own safety, and a lot of taxpayer dollars that are better applied rebuilding America than blowing up countries overseas, countries that never threatened us.
Former presidential candidate and consumer advocate Ralph Nader with his dangerous idea. To hear more dangerous ideas, visit our website, ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, to mark Memorial Day, a conversation with poet and Iraq War veteran Kevin Powers. He served as a machine gunner in 2004 and 2005 in Mosul and Tal Afar. When he came back, he wrote the award-winning novel The Yellow Birds, based on his war experience. And today, Charles Monroe Kane talks with him about his new poetry collection. They began with the title poem.
Letter composed during a lull in the fighting. I tell her I love her like not killing, or 10 minutes of sleep beneath the low rooftop wall on which my rifle rests. I tell her in a letter that will stink when she opens it of bolt oil and burned powder and the things it says. I tell her how Private Bartle says offhand that war is just us making little pieces of metal pass through each other.
That is a very powerful. I've read that poem like 10 times and it really affected me. What's the story behind that poem?
Really, the story behind the poem is about a year after I returned from overseas, I kind of went back to the tool that I had always kind of used to ask questions about my life, and that tool was writing. And I mean, I've always used it when confronted with the confusion and difficulty that the world presents us all with. So I was trying to reflect back to these moments I had when I was overseas where there would be a moment of space and quiet. In those times, you don't really have the kind of capacity to reflect in the way that you want to. And I was thinking, well, what would I say? You know, what would I have said to my mother, to my girlfriend, to anybody's loved one, brother, sister, husband? You know, what would I say? How would I communicate this? And I tried to find some kind of direct statement that I could make about what it's like to be in those moments, what it's like to feel the distance from not just those you love, but kind of the person that you were when you were close to them.
You know, it's funny, I'm listening to you talk and I start thinking that, you know, writers have to struggle with cliches, but if you're a poet, you really got to struggle with cliches. And if you're a poet who just fought a war, I mean, war is full of cliches. I mean, soldiers go to war to fight for their country and end up fighting for each other. No soldier returns from war the same person who went. You know, war is hell. There's no truth in war, only experience. You want to communicate with writing, but how do you navigate all the cliches?
Well, I mean, I think the difficult thing about a cliche is that it's something that's so true that we now take it for granted, right? So you try to present it in a way that not necessarily where the concept or the idea feels new, but the presentation of it feels new, so that when you do encounter this very old idea, like violence has an effect on those who participate in it and those who witness it, that when you see that very old and familiar idea, you react to it in a new way.
Could you read another poem for us? The poem Field Manual, I think, fits into this.
Sure.
Well.
I'll just turn to it.
Yeah, me too.
Field Manual. Think not of battles, but rather after. When the tremor in your right leg becomes a shake you cannot stop. when the burned man's tendon cheeks are locked into a scream that, before you sank the bullet in his brain to end it, had been quite loud. Think of how he still seems to scream. Think of not caring. Call this relief. Think heat waves rising from the dust. Think days of rest, how the sergeant lays the 22 into your palm and says the dogs outside the wire have become a threat to good order and to discipline. Some boys have taken them as pets. They spread disease. They bit a colonel preening for a TV crew. Think of afternoons in t-shirt and shorts, the unending sun, the bite of sweat in eyes. Think of missing so often it becomes absurd. Think quick pop, yelp, then puckered fur. Think skinny ribs. Think smell. Think almost reaching grief, but not quite getting there.
That end lining, think almost reaching grief, but not quite getting there, just shakes me to my core. Who's this field manual for? Is it for the 17-year-old who might enlist in the Army? Is this, who did you write it for?
Yes, it's for that person, but it's in a way it's intended as a manual for those people who were kind of dealing with memories like this. It's a way of, you know, articulating it, an appropriate response to the difficulty of the, you know, the emotional baggage that comes with these memories. I suppose in a way it's a statement of acceptance. I mean, one of the questions that I kept returning to is, by having these sort of extreme experiences, are you then forever defined by them and therefore limited by them? Or do you have the option to make a decision, to make different choices, to think of your experience in a different way, to allow the future to be different than the past? I suppose that the speaker of the poem is somebody who's on that line, at that point where that decision could potentially be made.
Kevin, I mean, just by writing it down, though, even though you do it beautifully, don't you fear that you're glorifying it? I know you're not into details, but just by being writing it down, maybe you are.
I don't think so. Okay. I hope not. You know, some of the poems in this book that I'm most, well, that I feel like are kind of accomplishing what I hope to accomplish are the ones where someone's getting close to kind of overcoming the difficulty of that experience. So it's not necessarily the experience of being in war that I'm hoping to celebrate. It's the experience of kind of returning to life.
You know, the New Yorker recently wrote an article about Iraqi war poetry. You were in it quite a bit throughout it. A really interesting article. And at the end, it says this. It says that of war, the story can only end in irony. Is that how you see all this ending? That it all ends in irony? After a whole article on war poetry, I was so disappointed in that ending, but I don't know if that's true. I haven't experienced it.
I mean, I don't know if, no, I don't know if that's true or not. I certainly think it's an argument that could be made. I mean, it is one way of kind of, I mean, I guess kind of contextualizing it and thinking about it. But no, for me, at least for the individuals who have gone through these experiences, maybe collectively we have to react to it ironically because we know that unfortunately war is not a thing that's going to end anytime soon. But for the individuals who've had these experiences, I think there is, as I was talking before, there is a genuine change that can come about. There is an ability to look at the preciousness of life in a new way, to acknowledge and appreciate that, to allow that to kind of guide your choices, your actions in the future. And I say that without even the slightest hint of irony. So,
well, thank you. I that's a beautiful ending. It gives a lot of hope. I would love if you could leave us with one more poem.
Sure. I think, I think I'll read a poem called Separation. I want the boys at the end of the bar to know, these young Republicans in pink popped collar shirts to know that laughter drives me mad. And if one must be old before one dies, then we were old. 19 or 23, and we were old, and now, as the fan spins and the light shines off their gelled hair and nails, I want to rub their clean bodies in blood. I want my rifle, and I want them to know how scared I am still alone in bars these 3 years later when I notice it is gone. I want the boys at the end of the bar to know that my rifle weighed 8 pounds when loaded, and on my first day home I made a scene in a bar, so drunk that I screamed and wept and begged for someone to give it back. How will I return fire? I cried. I truly cried. But no one could give it back because it was gone, and I felt so old, 24 and crying for my rifle, and the boys at the end of the bar were laughing.
Kevin Powers served in Iraq in 2004 and 2005. He talked with Charles Monroe Kane about his most recent volume of poetry, Letter, composed during a lull in the fighting. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio, and today we're saying goodbye to Stephanie Youngblood, who produced this hour. She is now Dr. Stephanie Youngblood, having just received her PhD in English from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Stephanie spent this year with us as our Public Humanities Fellow. Now she's off to new adventures. Offers are welcome. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced every week by Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, and Raymond Tungekar, with theme music by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.